Today is Monday, August 30th, and you are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, U.S. anti-missile defenses intercepts rockets fired at Kabul's airport.
What we have proven over time in other countries, Ed, is that we are capable of suppressing the terrorism threat, including external plotting capabilities, without a large permanent presence on the ground.
Plus, UN and aid agencies warn of growing rights abuses by the Taliban.
Aid agencies say Afghanistan is at a very dangerous point. They say an increasingly brutal conflict is worsening the already serious human rights violations in the country.
Also, alarm bells as North Korea appears to restart nuclear reactor. Our top story today is in Afghanistan. U.S. anti-missile defenses intercepted as many as five rockets that were fired at Kabul's airport early on Monday, as the United States rushed to complete its withdrawal from Afghanistan to end its longest war. Afghan media say Monday's rocket attack was launched from the back of a vehicle. The Patchwork News Agency said several rockets struck different parts of Afghan capital. In videos obtained by Reuters, residents were seen gathered near a burned-out vehicle. A large plume of black smoke was also seen rising among buildings from a distance. American forces on Sunday launched a drone strike targeting a suicide bomber in a vehicle who was also aiming to attack the airport. There is increasing concern that Islamic State militants will launch further attacks as U.S. troops hurry to evacuate more people before completing their own withdrawal by August 31st. As the U.S. evacuation efforts and military withdrawal come to a close in Afghanistan this week, President Joe Biden's decisions are facing intense scrutiny. Michelle Quinn reports on the criticism and the attack that left U.S. personnel and Afghan civilians dead in Kabul.
The final hours of evacuation from Afghanistan. Even after the August 31 deadline, the Biden administration says it will continue to work to bring U.S. citizens and Afghan allies out of the country. A senior Taliban official said people will be allowed to travel abroad in the future. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the international community will be watching.
114 countries have made very clear that it is their expectation that the Taliban will permit freedom of travel going past August 31st.
On Sunday, President Joe Biden honored the 13 U.S. military personnel who died in a suicide blast last week at the airport in Kabul. More than 100 Afghans were also killed. The U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan was going to be risky and chaotic, the administration says, and points to the success of airlifting more than 100,000 people in the past weeks. Critics say Biden has made numerous dangerous missteps.
President Biden said that he wanted to take this Afghanistan off the plate for future presidents. He's done the exact opposite. For the next 20 years, American presidents would be dealing with this catastrophe.
Jake Sullivan, the U.S. National Security Advisor, said intelligence reports indicate terrorist groups in Afghanistan do not have advanced external plotting capability, but the concern is that they could develop them.
What we have proven over time in other countries, Ed, is that we are capable of suppressing the terrorism threat, including external plotting capabilities, without a large permanent presence on the ground.
Going forward, Secretary Blinken says the U.S. is going to pay close attention to Afghanistan, but will not have a diplomatic presence there.
We're going to have to see exactly what happens in the weeks and months ahead in terms of how the Taliban conducts itself, what the security situation is in the country.
Blinken says that the possibility of one day returning to the country, which the U.S. occupied for nearly 20 years, remains to be seen. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
UN and private aid agencies say human rights violations have been surging in Afghanistan since Taliban militants seized control of the country. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Aid agencies say Afghanistan is at a very dangerous point. They say an increasingly brutal conflict is worsening the already serious human rights violations in the country. CEO of the Asia-Pacific Refugee Network, Najiba Wazadafost, says many people feared the resurgence of the Taliban as the U.S. and NATO withdrew troops from Afghanistan. But she says few people thought the Taliban would gain control over the country so quickly. She says it is horrifying to see the rapid escalation of human suffering and displacement under Taliban rule.
It has been quite heartbreaking, you know, especially in the past week, receiving vast amount of calls through our Afghan crisis helpline, where people have been reporting executions and beatings and clampdown on media and radio stations. They've been reporting to us about Taliban's, you know, door-to-door searches, targeted killings and looting in the capital. And again, we've been hearing about schools and hospitals and thousands of homes being attacked.
Wazadafost says she is most concerned about the voices of fear she is hearing from women. She says they talk about their fear of being killed simply because they are female. She says she fears border closures because of the pandemic, which will prevent women and girls fleeing violence and persecution from finding safety. Wazadafost is appealing to Western countries that are leaving Afghanistan to not abandon the women and girls left behind and leave them without hope and the support they need to survive their changed circumstances. The United Nations says decades of conflict compounded by a second drought in 4 years and the devastating socioeconomic impact of COVID-19 have wiped out Afghanistan's ability to survive without international support. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says nearly half of Afghanistan's population, about 18 million people, need humanitarian assistance. The head of OCHA's Coordination Division, Wafa Saeed Abdelatif, says at least a third of the population does not have enough to eat and is suffering from acute hunger.
We also estimate that half the children under 5 are acutely malnourished. And when a child is malnourished, this means also not access to enough food, to health, to water, to hygiene, to sanitation, and also malnutrition have a severe and irreversible impact on children. So this is something that we cannot let continue.
This year's United Nations humanitarian appeal for $1.3 billion has received just $500 million, leaving a funding gap of $800 million. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Top Middle Eastern and European leaders discussed prospects for peace, stability, and economic cooperation between Iraq and its neighbors during the weekend as they gathered in Baghdad for a summit. The leaders of Egypt, Jordan, and France met alongside the foreign ministers of Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Turkey, and the prime minister of Kuwait. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Regional leaders applauded as Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa Kazemi described his hopes for strengthening regional economic, political, and security cooperation to improve the lot of his people following years of turmoil. It was the first large gathering of top Arab leaders in Baghdad since the 2012 Arab summit. The presence of Iran's new foreign minister, Hussein Amir Abdollahian, at the summit provided a glimmer of optimism for a thaw in relations between Tehran and its top regional adversaries, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Speaking in Arabic, Abdollahian held out an olive branch to Arab states. He says that Iran would like to improve relations with countries in the region through economic and cultural cooperation without what he called the usual interference from international powers. Foreign interference, he argues, has created tensions and regional insecurity. French President Emmanuel Macron, the only major world leader to attend the summit, praised the Iraqi government for defeating a Islamic State, urging Baghdad to help resettle Iraqis who were displaced by the conflict and vowing French aid to do so. Speaking in a rapid clip, Saudi Foreign Minister Faisal bin Farhan spoke of Riyadh's ongoing cooperation with Iraq while vaguely referring to stopping Iranian interference in Iraq and elsewhere. He says Saudi Arabia has earmarked money for various projects in Iraq and reaffirms its support for Iraq's stability and putting an end to terrorism and extremism alongside the U.S.-led international coalition. He says that is in keeping with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's initiative for regional peace and stability and ending meddling by certain regional states. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi alluded to a recent economic and political alliance between Iraq, Egypt, and Jordan, and efforts to extend cooperation to other countries in the future. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
North Korea appears to have restarted a nuclear reactor that is widely believed to have produced plutonium for nuclear weapons, the UN Atomic Watchdog has said in an annual report. Jason Albano reports for Reuters.
North Korea could soon be resuming production of its nuclear weapons. In its annual report dated Friday, the International Atomic Energy Agency said Pyongyang appeared to have restarted a nuclear reactor believed to have once produced plutonium for the country's nuclear arsenal. It said in its report that for 2.5 years, there had been no indications of that reactor's operation at Yongbyon, a complex at the heart of Pyongyang's nuclear program, until July. It added that the apparent restart of the reactor coincides with indications of activity at a nearby uranium mine and plant. That comes after the IAEA said there had been signs at Yongbyon of possible reprocessing work to separate plutonium from spent reactor fuel earlier this year. The IAEA, which is the UN's atomic watchdog, called the new indications deeply troubling. It monitors North Korea from afar, largely through satellite imagery, after its inspectors were expelled by Pyongyang in 2009.
That was Jason Albano with Reuters. Two Egyptian lawyers say authorities released an online comedian, a journalist, and a political activist after they spent months in pretrial detention. It's the latest in a series of releases in recent months amid concerns by the U.S. government and international rights groups over the arrest and harassment of rights advocates and critics of the Egyptian president's government. Israel's defense minister has held talks with the Palestinian president in the first high-level meeting between the two sides in years. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz said the talks took place in Ramallah in the Israel-occupied West Bank. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. In the Netherlands, lawyers from an international law firm has filed a petition calling on the International Criminal Court to investigate the Saudi-led coalition's conduct in the war in Yemen. The lawyers from Gonika 37 International Justice Chambers of London said they've submitted evidence compiled by survivors, their relatives and families of the deceased who were killed during the war. The group represents more than 200 victims of the war. Toby Cadman is lead attorney representing the war victims. He tells VOA's Peter Clote that the court in The Hague must hold accountable those responsible for what he says were gross human rights violations and crimes against humanity.
So we have been documenting a number of attacks over the last few years by the Saudi-led coalition. Now, of course, Yemen is not a state party to the Rome Statute, so it's not a member of the International Criminal Court. Neither is Saudi Arabia or United Arab Emirates. But because there are a number of members of the coalition who are members of the International Criminal Court, we are submitting the case against those members, of which Jordan, Maldives, and Senegal is included. So we are arguing that the International Criminal Court has jurisdiction by virtue of those countries being members of the coalition and having participated in the conflict in Yemen. And as a result, the ICC has jurisdiction. There is also a number of Latin American states that includes Colombia, El Salvador, Panama, and Chile, who have engaged in the use of mercenaries in Yemen. Many of them who have been trained in the United States have been operating in the south of Yemen, responsible for carrying out abductions, torture, extrajudicial killings, and enforced disappearance. And of course, as any citizen of those countries, they can fall within the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. And so on the basis of those categories of offences, we say that there is a justifiable basis for the International Criminal Court to open an investigation into the situation in Yemen.
Some people are doubtful whether your case will meet one of the three thresholds under which the International Criminal Court would decide to look into a matter. How do you respond to that?
Well, certainly in any case where you're submitting what's called an Article 15 communication to the court or to the prosecutor, there are a number of criteria, admissibility criteria, that you have to meet. And of course, you have to be able to not only establish that the ICC has jurisdiction over those states or citizens of those states, but you also have to establish that there are crimes that fall within the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court, and that you are able to meet the threshold of gravity. We are satisfied on the basis of the evidence that we have collected over the last 9 months. We have taken statements from a large number of victims that have been involved in attacks. We have cited, certainly in the press release, three particular attacks, two of them, some of the most egregious, one of them being an attack on a school bus and one of them being an attack at a funeral. That very clearly satisfies the gravity threshold for the International Criminal Court to open investigation.
That's VOA's Peter Clote speaking with Toby Cadman, lead attorney representing the victims of the war in Yemen. Israel has expanded its COVID booster vaccination campaign to all Israelis over age 12, becoming the first country in the world to offer the third shot widely. Israel officials say vaccine efficiency wanes sharply after 6 months, and the booster shot is proven to be effective. Linda Granstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
Every Israeli over age 12 who received their second dose of the vaccine at least 5 months ago is now eligible for a third booster shot. Israel began giving the booster shots to anyone over 60 earlier this month and has now expanded the campaign, making it the first country in the world to do so. Professor Cyril Cohen, a member of the Advisory Committee for Clinical Trials at the Israeli Ministry of Health, told Israel Radio he is convinced the booster is necessary.
We have data that show that there is a real reduction of the effectiveness of the vaccine in preventing infections. I'm not talking about severe cases, but infections starting around, 5 to 6 months after the vaccination. And therefore, the Israeli government has decided to allow whoever wants to get a third dose.
Israel's government also announced that anyone who has received a third vaccine or who received their second vaccine within the past 6 months will be exempt from quarantine after international travel. The move excludes a handful of so-called red countries where COVID-19 rates are high, including Brazil, Mexico, Spain, and Turkey. The announcement sparked a wave of ticket purchases, as many Israelis held off traveling because of a week-long quarantine upon return. The announcement comes as COVID rates in Israel remain high, although beginning to decline. Nachman Ash is the Director General of Israel's Health Ministry. He said that Israel is applying the brakes to the fourth wave of COVID, and he is cautiously optimistic that the rates will start to go down. There are currently more than 700 cases of patients who are seriously ill in Israeli hospitals, and almost 7,000 have died since the beginning of the pandemic. Almost 2 million Israelis, out of a total population of 9 million, the official said, have already received the third dose. At the same time, there are several upcoming events that could cause a spike in the number of cases. Schools open on Wednesday, and parents are supposed to test their children at home and report the results. but there is concern that parents may not do the tests or do them improperly. In addition, next week is Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, and large family gatherings are expected. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Health authorities in Fiji say a six-month-old baby has become the youngest victim of a worsening coronavirus outbreak. Hundreds of new infections are being reported every day, and officials have warned the virus was likely to remain in Fiji as an endemic disease like the common flu. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Cases of COVID-19 have been reported across Fiji, a South Pacific archipelago that lies about two-thirds of the way from Hawaii to New Zealand. The government confirmed 396 new cases by late Sunday. The World Health Organization has reported more than 45,000 coronavirus cases in Fiji since the pandemic began, while Fijian health officials have said 479 people have died. The vast majority of fatalities have come since the latest outbreak began in April. Among the victims are a six-month-old baby and an 11-year-old girl. Fiji's coronavirus emergency is centered on the main island of Viti Levu. So far, authorities have said the second-largest island, Vanua Levu, has escaped the worst of the pandemic. However, former Fiji Health Minister Dr. Neil Sharma told Radio New Zealand that the island was ill-prepared should infections increase.
Levu has a much smaller population, but the health facilities are very limited. One divisional hospital in the north and a subdivisional hospital, which are rather small, they would eventually fall short of supplies. The virus has been moving faster than strategic planning has gone.
Senior officials fear that the coronavirus will never be eliminated in Fiji and will become endemic. About 1 million people live in Fiji. The government says more than 45% of eligible people were fully vaccinated, far more than in neighbouring Australia and New Zealand. In New Caledonia, doctors and employers have called for compulsory coronavirus inoculations, fearing a catastrophe if the Delta variant was to reach that South Pacific island nation. It closed its international borders in March last year and remains free of COVID-19. But just a third of the population of about 300,000 has been inoculated, according to authorities. The Kingdom of Tonga has also recorded no coronavirus cases. It's a different story in other parts of the Pacific. The U.S. territory of Guam has reported 9,500 infections and 145 deaths since the pandemic began. Papua New Guinea has reported 18,000 COVID-19 cases and 192 fatalities, according to the WHO. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Australia's most popular state, New South Wales, the epicenter of its current COVID-19 outbreak, will hit a peak in intensive care hospitalizations in October as cases accumulate, as the state saw a record number of new infections on Monday. Libby Hogan reports.
As the COVID death toll crosses 1,000 in Australia, the government is preparing to switch its approach. Up until now, the country has implemented fortress-style controls, closing borders and placing half the population in lockdown. But authorities have dispensed with plans to crush the virus and say that Australians have to learn to live with it. Australia is making that decision even as infections rise. New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian issued the grim warning that October will be the worst month for the state's intensive care units.
Our hospital system is under pressure. Will we need to do things differently? Of course we will. Will we need to manage things differently? We're in the middle of a pandemic. Of course. But will we cope? Of course we will.
Australia's early success quelling the virus has been replaced with public frustration at a delayed vaccine rollout. Just over 33% of those aged 16 and older have received two vaccine doses, well below most comparable countries. As the wary nation reopens, health experts have cautioned that mask wearing needs to continue. Tourism operators have joined the chorus of mounting anger at the government, pointing to the devastating impact that the restrictions have had on their industry. In the state of Queensland, home to the Great Barrier Reef, Daniel Schwind, head of Queensland's Tourism Council, says local tour operators are struggling. He estimates the state is losing $5 billion a year from international tourism and as much as $730 million a month from other parts of the country.
You've had cyclones and floods and bushfires and pretty much everything else that you can throw at us, but we've always overcome. But this one is the most profound disruption that we've ever faced, because most importantly, there is no immediate end in sight.
Meanwhile, business owners in Sydney, which has been the epicentre of the Delta outbreak, are still grappling with a loss to the bottom line after 3 months of restrictions.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Anania Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great evening.